Good morning, everyone, esteemed fellows and research group members. It's my honor to present Ted Gutschit, who is a former fellow here at OsloMet. And one of the key reasons that we're doing a new focus seminar presentation here today is that we did not have the perfect crystal crisp sound recording on his previous occasion, being here last fall. So Ted has been interested in completing his fellowship by doing this focus seminar presentation with a good audio recording. And of course, things happen over time. Ted has since then published a few books and special issues and many other things. So we can kind of update the research review and topic and align it a little bit with the theme of this information, although we'll still have some critical elements, some Trump, some politics, and some wicked ideas, as other scholars such as Torsten Quandt would say. So I think we'll be expecting a good journey here, journalism of the future, understanding issues of power, disinformation, trust in the press of today and tomorrow.
Great.
Setting the bar.
Welcome. We'll see. Thank you. So thanks for having me back to do this. And being part of the disinformation conversation over the last couple of days, I think it'll bring some new perspectives into this project. It's early stages, still early days, as they say where I'm from. And so any feedback would be really helpful to kind of put this into future steps. So I'm interested. I was watching Blade Runner, the new Blade Runner, and I was thinking, oh yeah, this is a really great film. Like, I really love this. It's really awesome. Okay, this is great. And then I thought, like, you know, a former journalist and as somebody who studies it, where are the journalists? What would they look like? What would they be doing? How would they be reporting on these things? Would they be reporting on these things? And then, of course, Black Panther, which, to be clear, is not necessarily set in the future, whereas Blade Runner is, right? Somebody will correct me, I'm sure, right in the front row. Along the current Marvel Universe timeline, more or less. Okay, so, but still, in terms of racial ideologies, it is positioned in a future sense of equality, power, and inequalities, and so ideologically it is positioned. I thought, well, where are the journalists? What do they look like? What do they do? So then, I don't know, in Northern England we don't do much, apparently, because then I went back to several different instances, and this is from Star Trek Generations, came out in 1994. This is positioned in 2371. This is the launching of a new spaceship. And one of the opening scenes includes journalists recording this from, like, the boots on the ground, eyewitness report, the video, audio, going to the official, getting the crowd response when they're opening up, you know, so very much what journalists look like today. And I thought, oh, 2371 and we haven't evolved? That's a really interesting conversation. And then Minority Report, back in 2002, positioned in 2054. We have USA Today being viewed on a tram, in its electronic ink, very similar to what, well, more advanced than what Esquire did a few years ago when they brought out electronic ink, which after, I don't remember how long, kind of just froze, sitting on my shelf frozen. So I show it to students and say, this is electronic ink. It went from different images and told you different things, and then, like, the battery wore out. And so it's positioned. But here, you know, this is talking not only about, this is just a little scene about how where journalism appears. This is about, you know, predictive policing and surveillance and other things in that film. But it talked about journalism, and I thought, well, that's interesting because they see journalism in 2054 still being an institution of social importance. So then I just kind of started looking through and thinking, how do we talk conventionally about the future of journalism? And I say futures of journalisms, just to kind of hedge my bets a little bit, but also to include that there are multiple futures from multiple perspectives and communities, and also journalisms, as we've been talking about the last few days. And it seemed to me that, and I write about this a little bit in this project, but that the conventional concerns deal with the social function of news, journalistic authority and legitimacy. They're different things, but they often get grouped together. So who is a journalist? Professionalism, intersections with digital spheres and technologies, and the role of audiences. Am I missing any? This seems to be kind of like the big groupings, but we can talk about that. And I thought, okay, well, so what are the conventional outcomes of the future, you know, in these ways? And, you know, news aggregation. And I kind of like that this one's pixelated because to me it represents kind of the blurring of everything that kind of comes in at you, both in terms of your imagination of what's on the screen, but then also the particular items. So I kept that one pixelated. Personalized news pushing, robot journalism, and I don't mean to diminish robot journalism by putting an actual robot because I understand that that's not what it is. But what's interesting about this, have you seen this before? This was a private security company in San Francisco using robots to move homeless along. So when there were people experiencing homelessness on the sidewalk, this would come along with its camera, it would document it, but it also in some versions have voice activation of, you know, it's almost like start, move along. I mean, I don't think that was the, but how is this, when this becomes our future, how are the pieces of information from here going to be distributed to and among journalists? The surveillance video or the data that the robots, beyond how we're already talking about algorithms and robot journalism as we see it today, retinal implants? Okay. I don't know that people are really putting forth papers to digital journalism about retinal implants just yet, but probably soon, right? Google Glass kind of came and went, but I think there's still an interest in how are we embedding these things. We have wearables. Now we're going to be moving into the embedded elements. But the conventional conversations always seem to go to wanting a public sphere, right? Involvement, audiences, civicness, and in Western elements, you know, the sense of democracy. But I'm more interested in critical perspectives, particularly those that have to do with issues of ideology. So I'm interested in power and control. I'm interested in how journalism is used as a function of society to erect and maintain appropriate behaviors, beliefs, social roles. How might journalism adapt or change in those ways, using technology, but also maintaining whatever we think its social function might be beyond civicness and the conventional means, but into issues of power and control. Capitalism and public good, right? The tension between those two things. And we talked a lot about that in the last couple days, that they don't necessarily always align, particularly if we look at journalistic interactions with Facebook. Data from both the News Corporation and Facebook as a corporation, neither of them are very willing to share much information, right? So News Corp isn't going to share information just as well as Facebook isn't going to share information. And technology and social surveillance. I include this because this is a early drivable or a personless car, right? And what's interesting about some of this is there are studies that are suggesting that black folk, people with darker skin, are more likely to get run over by an automated car than a person with lighter skin. Some of that's rooted into the technology, but that's rooted into how the humans are using the technology to make decisions about the lines on the road, what is something that can be represented as something to avoid or not. These are the programmers putting some of this in. So I'm interested in particularly race. Coming from the States, that's one of the things I'm. And then living in Northern England, it's very interesting. It's different, but so the question, one of the questions is what's an analysis? So tapping into race, I typed into Google Images, right? Journalistic future journalist or something like that, right? And I got this image of a nice light-skinned guy. Oh, and then, of course, something that just came out, I think it was even earlier this year, AI journalist in China. China. And, you know, we've had hologram journalists, so there's some of that. That's maybe an element of the future. I kind of like this. This has nothing to do with journalism. But it kind of represents the different elements of what, I mean, maybe not the gun. Maybe, I don't know. Depending on your definition of alternative media, perhaps, I don't know. But how journalists are using all the different technologies around them to write about not just everydayness, but the social contestation and crisis within our communities using these technologies. Now, like I said, I typed in futuristic journalist and variations of that, and it only showed like light-skinned men and women and the role of being a journalist, which I thought was also part of the problem for at least a critical scholar of saying, well, that's really interesting. Is that what we see future journalists being? Now, again, that wasn't a hyper-scientific method, but I thought it was interesting. So the research aims of this project are to really understand what some of the conventional conversations are about the future for journalism, and I'll talk about kind of how I'm going to do that in the next slide. The complications about issues of power and the potential influences of practice that could today occur, not just to change what might be, but what's actually happening now. And then, of course, the internationality. I understand that my perspective is mostly in the United States, and so there are lots of culturally sensitive differences there. So my approach is, and this is, again, a cursory sort of look at social futures. At Lancaster, we have an Institute for Social Futures started by John Urey and others. And so it has different elements that put together how you can do these predictions or these scenarios for the future. This isn't new. People have long ago thought about what ifs and what does the future look like. It's appeared, as I showed, in fiction as well as in scholarship. There's some influences, though. Human action and agency independence can change what your predictions might be for the future. So, for instance, when we're thinking about these, think about the Concorde, hyper-fast wave of the future of ways of getting back over the ocean from the UK to the States. It did okay for a while, and then it stopped, in large part because of some of these factors. Right? Economics, right? Advanced technology and maintenance of technologies. So the prediction of, you know, a transporting yourself immediately from one space to another just has maybe taken a back burner because of some of the different influences of what people really want, what they want to spend their money on, what the costs are, and the complexities that go into it. So future studies talks about, and there's a great methodology to this. I want to get to the scenarios, but the great methodology to this is a rigorous reading of patterns and trends, right? But taking into account these things. So the patterns and trends of how people have talked about the introduction of new technologies and futures before gives us a sense of how we might be talking about them now, looking ahead. So if journalists in the 1800s were talking about the telegraph as being a way to make the world smaller, getting information faster, or shipping news, right, of the ships that would bring in international news from its journeys into a single port and then be distributed back out. How did that replicate itself in conversations of the internet or in the complications of WhatsApp or Snapchat? Or what's coming next. So it's looking specifically at how journalists and journalism studies scholars talk about innovation. So some of this method needs to be tightened up. Let's talk about it. But it's looking at some of the leading, you know, what are the leading journals and trade publications and websites saying about the future. It's creating scenarios, and I'll share some. There'll be some storytelling today. provide some potential action, but again, this is rooted in a critical approach of, you know, mixes of Gramsci and Foucault, perspectives from bell hooks, those types of, Stuart Hall, those types of approaches, Giroux and others. And it does begin with my premise that issues of disinformation in journalism are rooted in, wait for it, notions of the propaganda model, which is still a highly contested perspective, but I don't really care. I think we contest it because we don't want to believe it. And I don't know that we know how to solve it. So, with that in mind, let's do some storytelling. You are not going to read this. I am going to read it to you. The one thing you're not supposed to do with a PowerPoint presentation, but it's a story. And these are very amateurish, so they're just to highlight. Lena always tries new things, ice cream, music genres, tech. So when she approached the higher tech unit of Daily Dispatch, where she had sometimes provided tips on her local community and had a large audience following because she matched the desirable age and young professional positions that the dispatch wanted, she was on board. So that Monday, after her eyes healed from the minor surgery, the news outlet and tech innovators who invented the product split the cost, Lena is set to test the retinal implant. She shows her corporate media, and news and captures what she sees in the world. The journalist she works with now will better understand the city through her eyes. Her likes and dislikes will help them to know what audience might want, and the camera is a perfect way to capture any news she may see while she's out and about. Today, journalists wanted to know more about a down-and-out neighborhood known for crime and racial tension, but also with a rising art scene. That's actually coming from my experience in Miami, a place called Wynwood that has moved pretty much all black folk out to bring in light-skinned Latinos and white folk. We'll just leave that there. And by the way, the media love it. Lena captured images with her eyes of families laughing, playing in the street, coming home from their daily jobs. But a large black man, I know, Americans are so very specific about what the racial tension's on. Hurrying by to get his child from the neighborhood school, accidentally bumps into Lena, apologizing. Lena doesn't hear it. She falls to the ground, which the man doesn't see. She moves her retina to the left and clicks undesirable as an option in a virtual menu. No one will not want news from here. So why am I thinking that that might be where we might be going? Well, a lot of the conversations about solutions journalism, engagement with audiences, focuses on particular audiences, the desirable audiences, the people with disposable time and income to purchase and interact with our media. This is an example from South Africa. This happens quite frequently in the States. Let's have coffee together. The editors from this news organization are going to meet over a cup of coffee tomorrow morning. The editors, section and news editors, reporters, and sub-editors will have their pens posed, waiting to hear what you'd like to see covered in our pages. We will be at the following coffee shops between 9 a.m. and 11 a.m. I don't remember what day of the week it was. Let's say Tuesday. It doesn't really matter, right? Who are the individuals who can go to coffee between 9 and 11 a.m.? Right? Where are they coming from? Are they working service jobs? Do they have caring responsibilities? But yet, this is a good idea, perhaps, right? I mean, at least the journalists are leaving the newsroom. But what are they getting from that? And also, what is the meaning of going to a coffee shop? Does that resonate with all the different audiences? Is that a meeting space that means, is that the same as going to a church basement? Is that the same as meeting at mosque? Is that the same as going to the playground? Or going to a place of work? What is that, going to somebody's living room? I'm not suggesting journalists intrude people's living rooms any more than they already do. But I think that this is hinting at issues of gaining resources from elites. And I see that growing. I also see the technological component of live feeds growing. And one example, which I know is entertainment, but in the States, we have something called Live PD, which is the television show Cops that came out in the 80s, which documented a bunch of white police officers beating the crap out of black people, and audiences loved it. It still goes on. And it was kind of shot in the live moment, in the moment. It's like live to tape, right? This apparently is live. And segments of the country, they feed in live streams of police doing their jobs. And here's Dan Abrams, a legal correspondent and reporter for NBC and MSNBC, standing here for the A&E channel, talking to police officers about the work that they're doing out in the communities as entertainment. So it's a mixture of live feed, right? Confusion of news and entertainment, but yet sharing of authority between journalists, the entertainment systems, and police. So I see that there are several of these things coming out, and I think that the live feed notion might increase. We'll go quickly through these. Ronald, always a Saints in a Saints football hat. I'm thinking that this is Ronald. I don't know who this is. Heard the gunshots that came from next door. Out, he ran from his house in New Orleans, and the air a buzzing. Small lights flash. Someone yells to anyone listening, "He's dead!" I loved cops reporting, so that's why a lot of these focus on this. On the ground, police hover literally on the state of their air boards, skirting around street corners, barely missing the stop signs. A sound sensor from the local TV station had captured the pops. The hardware is anchored below police surveillance cameras featuring facial recognition software. A partnership between the police and press, as neither group had the funds to pull off the tech upgrade themselves. Ronald looks up in the streetlight, captures the TV station's call signs. But he looked too long. Already his image was streaming in both the newsroom and on Cops handheld sponsored, which are sponsored by all the segments of the news, by the corporations who made the sensors. I wrote this on the airplane and apparently didn't edit it very well. And the drones are used by journalists. While reporters were careful not to name him the suspect, his face was pushed everywhere without him even knowing. I've used censored journalism and spent 3 months putting together the censored journalism entry on Wikipedia. That was a lot of time for something that doesn't really matter, but it's there. So sensors will continue to become something that are really helpful for journalists to get independent evidence, right, to participate with citizens, because a lot of these are efforts that are joint ventures of going out and talking about air quality, water quality, things that can be quantified by citizens and used by journalists to interpret life. But I also think that, again, there's a surveillance component that is becoming normalized in journalism, if it hasn't been already after generations. And I think that I see us going in directions of partnerships with, again, police and other institutions. It could be healthcare with their massive capturing of patient data. It could be movie theaters capturing what tickets were sold. Oh, that already happens. Okay. And so I see these collaborations among institutions increasing using technology to surveil. So, for instance, in Australia, there's an effort already happening. There's a partnership between one of the news organizations and a police department. The police department puts up on its Facebook page some stories on this thing called iWatch. Even the language itself, right? iWatch, spelled E-Y-E, watch. Where it puts out its stories about what's going on and who they need to catch. What the news organization is doing, and this is the Hume leader, with their thing called Street Watch, is directly taking that information from their Facebook. This is a partnership between them, and republishing it. Now, this is very much like what we would call in the news business briefs, right? These are police briefs. We've done this forever, right? But they're copying and pasting these stories back and forth between the two institutions. And they're doing so because they believe that it's a good public service for both the police to be catching criminals, but also journalists to be trying to catch criminals. We ask journalists in the States a lot, if you've seen this, call Crime Stoppers, right? Well, it's kind of hard to come out and say, well, I don't see what the problem, I mean, it's easy to say, I don't see what the problem is with that. You know, if somebody did something, it's our job to help people catch the criminal if we possibly can. We're not judging them. We're just putting this out there and allowing the citizens to participate in their own safety. Right? That seems to be like a really logical conversation to have, right? But it's also contributing to a normalization and a naturalization of a surveillance state that's going completely into spheres that we don't even understand yet in terms of how much we're watching. So it's even a surveillance of we're watching each other, the watchers being watched and back and forth. But it's also in the language that journalists have always, if I may say something so bold, have always adopted from police and back and forth about legitimacy and authority related to crimes and potential criminals. So if you look at these examples really, really quick, so of course we're saying police are continuing to search for an alleged criminal, right? That's good, maybe. But here, a suspicious house fire, right? Well, yeah, the police said it's suspicious, so we should say it's suspicious. But I think we really need to be paying attention a little bit more to why are we saying what they're saying it is, right? And why doesn't that appear in another sentence? Police called this, quote-unquote, suspicious. Well, we don't have as much room. We need to write tighter. We don't have as many words, right? I think that we need to think about where this language is coming from in these relationships going into the future. Who's coming up with that term? Here's another one, and this is, again, where anyone with information about her whereabouts is urged to contact police. So this call to action, again, goes back to the previous conversation about this. And I think, as I say here, it engages audiences as being crime fighters. And I see that increasing already. We won't go through this whole thing, but I'm interested in not only predictive policing, where we're using metrics, and we're integrating that with facial recognition and other softwares to make the idea of who's more likely to create a crime based upon a whole set of socioeconomic pieces of information, right? And backgrounds and data that suggest that if you come from here, of this background, of this age, with a family, of this history, or this was Minority Report and other pieces of fiction. But it's happening particularly in terms of smart cities, okay? So smart cities are embedded with sensors and hackers and coders and people who are capturing movements, phone calls, not necessarily maybe the content, although I'm sure, use of resources, and trying to make some statements about who we are as communities and where we're going. And that's really good resource. Those are really good resources for journalists to take and repurpose without maybe asking some questions about, well, who's collecting this data? So for instance, if we were talking about crime in a neighborhood, right? Let's take where I was living in Miami. If neighborhood A has five police officers assigned to that, neighborhood B has one, which neighborhood's going to have more crime? Well, statistically, it's going to be A, because there are more cops there walking around, having contact, and typing things into their computer. And journalists know that. I mean, we're smart people. We're not idiots. I don't think we're extremely gullible. I think we're really critical. But for some, at some point, we just seem to take that because of its quantifiability, right? I mean, some people were talking about that yesterday. I refer to that, as maybe some other people do, too, as journalistic evidence, because that's something that can be proven, right? But it's also up to the police officer. So when I was living in Iowa, on a neighborhood that I studied for the first book I did, three black men on a street corner, that constituted a police contact and was, depending on how the conversation went, a disturbance or not. But when my ex-wife and I, we're both white folk living in the historic part, I mean, it was a little shitty house, so it wasn't like as grand as it sounds, but in the historic place called Goose Town, which is called Goose Town because the first inhabitants had lots of geese that would run through the alley, so it was called Goose Town, right? Anyway, we lived there. And if we were having a loud discussion or an argument, hence the ex-wife part, that's a joke, you can laugh, the police might see that, or the neighbors certainly might see that as, well, you know, she's a law student, he's a PhD student. They just have really engaging conversations. But if people on this other neighborhood were having loud conversations about whatever, maybe their own PhD studies or something else, that entered into data in a very different way. And so I'm concerned about how what I consider to be collusion between police and journalists is only going to continue, fueled by really problematic capturing of information. Here we go back to smart cities as an example. Ring, are you familiar with this? The doorbell that captures the video live stream of who's at your door. You can see it on your phone wherever you are, and you can correspond back to them and say, go away, or leave the package in the bushes, or whatever it is that you're going to say. Well, what's happening here is these are becoming networked between houses in neighborhoods so that they can surveil or just watch out for other neighbors. So you can tap into other people's Ring's backgrounds and have conversations about what is going on in your neighborhood. This is at a real micro level of neighbors. In fact, I once went to some friends for curry, and we were sitting in their living room, or in their kitchen, and the place was really hot. And I'm like, oh my God, this place is so hot. Okay, it'll take me a second. Maybe not a nice thing to say about somebody's house. They had just been cooking and working really hard to give you dinner, and you're complaining about how hot it is. After dinner, we sit down, and we're watching their inside internal cameras, watching the dog upstairs. Is the dog going to open the door and come out and visit us? And we sat there for 20 minutes watching the dog upstairs about whether the dog was going to come out or not. And then they rewound the tape, and I thought, oh God, they're going to see me complaining about how hot their house is. I hope they don't rewind too much, right? This wasn't a fancy house. This was a basic two-floor apartment. These people didn't make tons of money. It was affordable in the marketplace. And I didn't know in their house that I was actually being watched and recorded the entire time. And so was the dog. And so I think a lot of these things are being so normalized. In the States, for instance, you are not, the military is not allowed to have, by law, to the degree it's followed, access to technology that citizens can't also use. So while Barack Obama, and not just Barack Obama, but maybe Donald Trump, are using Predator drones, right? Now, 5 years ago, we started to have the little drones that came out. You know, we're sharing in that technology that actually went forth into violence before it became naturalized in our space. And a positive note, this is a shot from The Guardian in the London riots from several years ago. This wasn't predictive in any way. This was kind of an early form of maybe some sort of smart city stuff, but also citizen journalism and reporting from different neighborhoods about violence that was going on, and just a beautiful project. So you can go here and take a look at their coverage of the mapping with the videos and photos of what's going on. But what I like about the project more than just this was they did an amazing job. And I think Emily Bell was involved in this, but I may have to take that back. I might take that back. Yeah. And so was that they did research about why these riots were happening.
Spotted a beast.
Go ahead.
Spotted a beast was the one.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sorry. Thanks. And so doing the research about why these things were happening, and they were basically the same reasons from why the riots had happened, 20 years, 30 years prior. I mean, issues of class and race divides in policing and lots of other similar themes. But they were asking people, why do you think this is happening? At the same time as saying, what was happening? And so I think that this is a good example of maybe not predicting, but using the data that are coming in to ask people, why? What do you make of this data instead of just us telling them? This other one I won't read, but this has to do with journalists dealing in insider secrets between in politics and in business, having been doing some business reporting for the Chicago Tribune and then doing a little stint on Capitol Hill, journalism at the local level even. It's really interesting that we don't really talk about journalists and insider trading. I mean, the amount of information that journalists as individuals have about corporate sectors is fascinating. And I would love to just take a look at their portfolio and really understand if you're on CNBC reporting on medical waste disposal sector, what are the policies that you must abide by to announce to the audience if you purchase or not within that stock market? Are there policies? Sure. But what are the policies and who's doing what and where is their money going? I think is a really interesting question to ask. I think The Hill is a really good example. One thing I'm giving away, one of my ideas that I'd like to do some point, is The Hill, for instance, is a news organization on Capitol Hill for staffers, really. It's an insider, it's publicly available, but it's insider journalism about what bills are coming to the floor, what the relationships are between different people. And we don't really seem to do much scholarship on this or the other Congressional Quarterly and other sort of insider journalism. So I'm sure one of you will pick up on that, and then I won't get to do that study. And you can read more about this certainly in some of this work. So what are the summaries and takeaways here? I think the social futures of journalism, despite the rhetoric that's coming through in the conferences we go to, the papers we write, the trade publications, is that it's socially centered, right? I think that conversation that's socially centered to move us towards a sense of democracy is actually creating a greater gap between the press and undesirable audiences. Again, those people who don't have the disposable time or income to consume and interact as we would like them to through their pocketbooks or through their going to a public hearing. I mean, for instance, when I was covering local journalism, it was surprising how many public, I would quote, how many public officials would say, well, this piece of policy that we're talking about is about their neighborhood. Why are they not here to talk about this policy about their neighborhood? Has anybody ever heard that as a reporter? Well, wait a second. I mean, first of all, you're asking people from an area potentially that is hugely surveilled by police to come into a police institution of the city hall where there might be warrants, but certainly they just might not trust this institution. So of course they're not going to come here, or they're working, or they're just not, that's your job to go to public meetings. There are lots of reasons, but journalists tend to follow in that same sort of frustration, I think, that they don't get the sources from the communities in institutional spaces, such as a city council room or something like that. And so I think that even though it's socially centered uses of technology, I think that it's creating more social distance. To bring it to the disinformation, in those gaps of the social distance, I think that's where that disinformation comes in. When that, and this isn't new, when the trust is low, right, or the trust is really ideologically based, as we talked about over the last couple of days and for a while now, you're going to go to where that information is, whether it's disinformation to you or not. And I think it's that social distance that we're increasing that's making this even more problematic. I think critical cultural theory isn't used very often to have these conversations. Certainly the rolls of eyes that I get, not necessarily in this room, but when I talk about propaganda model, which I've only mentioned once or twice today, is really astounding. It's something that I think we need to evaluate within journalism studies. Where is that critical theory, particularly in U.S. journalism studies work? My time's almost up, but really quick, everybody wants to ask what the solutions are. That's the worst question I hate that question, but I'll give it to you anyway so we can end on a sense of a positive note. That I think journalists can do some really basic things that they're refusing to do. This isn't the first time this has been said, but journalists refused to do these things. Full source lists. Who did you talk to? Who was mentioned? Who wasn't mentioned? That seems really simple, right? We have the technology called Excel to do that. I mean, there are lots of ways to do this. Tracing of the reporting stages. I love how project journalism does say, we did this, we talked to this. That's time consuming. But it becomes less time consuming as you're trained in the practice of doing this through repetition, right? Journalist bios, that came up the other day. Why is it so hard to put a bio on a website about who a journalist is and what their connections are, where they went to school, if they did or if they didn't, who they consider themselves to be? I don't know why that's hard. You could get an intern, a paid intern, to do that. Network and narrative analysis. I think we have a really great place to play in these changes of working with journalists to analyze the work that they're doing. That's what we do anyway, right? How do we get that in their hands and how do we make them a part of this? Publish corrections on TV news. I'm particularly thinking about local TV news in the U.S. I don't think I've ever heard or seen a correction. Doesn't mean it might not have happened. Where do those corrections in that medium appear, right? Particularly when we're dealing with mobile audiences who are watching videos that are then put onto YouTube. Where do those corrections follow? Re-reporting on stories. God forbid, there's always an empty budget. One of the reasons I left journalism was I was tired of editors saying, my budget's empty. You have to fill my budget. No, you get paid more than me. It's your job to fill the budget. I'll just help you bring your ideas to fruition, right? I think basic, one of my issues is with police reporting, basic change, multiple source police reporting. Right? We don't go to the neighbor to say, what do you think is going on in this neighborhood? Because that's not an official source. She's an eyewitness, right? But yet, the lieutenant, who's never been there before, that's a very solid source. We should talk about labor journalism, not business reporting. Scholars could consider local news. A lot of the conversations the last couple of days about disinformation were about national and international news. I think there are several reasons for that. Access to information, the interest in the conversations, the level of discourse that's being had. So I certainly think there's a legitimate reason for doing that. But I'm really concerned about what's going on at that local level and what are those connections between there. Apply, again, critical cultural theory. Here's some examples of mine, anyway, that I think kind of get to that. I'm happy to share. And that was just about 2 minutes over. So, thank you very much. Would you like me to take questions now or just over coffee?
We can take a little bit of a question session before we have some coffee.
Yeah.
Elbridge, University of Columbia, I'm curious to
ask. I'll repeat your question. I'll repeat your question for the video so that.
Good luck.
No, you good luck. I may not get it right.
I thought this was really interesting in the million directions at once, sort of like there's a lot, not in a bad way, but it brings up a whole lot of ideas, like when you were talking yesterday about how you can use teaching to explore some of these things. We teach using design fictions, right? So you could imagine using this sort of design fiction approach, which you kind of often
and
as a way to bring in critical theory into research. You say, all right, here's a hypothetical future. Well, actually, it's not so hypothetical. Mm. We already have surveillance, monitorial citizenship, etc. And I like some of your solutions towards the end, and that's even speaking as someone who used to work at Insider Washington Publishers.
So, oh, there you go.
Yeah, but I think there's a risk of pushing the critical lens that... forget, like, and there are a lot of power relationships that you are rightly pointing towards. Mm-hmm. But I think something that's missing, and I'm wondering if you have a thought on this, is that the objects of surveillance in our society are not just members beyond the newsroom and beyond City Hall and beyond municipalities, but journalists are being surveyed by local police and national authorities.
Yeah.
So when you say, why don't they just put bios up? I can think of a lot of reasons why they don't just put bios up. why isn't there a more explicit source record? You can think of a lot of reasons why there's not a more explicit source record. So some of, I think there's, I'm getting
to this,
but I wonder if there's a risk of you push too aggressively towards a critical lens in one way, and you miss out that there's a lot of people caught up in the back.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's great, and lots of good points about role of education. I'm just repeating it for education and using these types of ideas and methods to get through some of the critical ideas, but then also some of the pitfalls. I think of what you're saying of if you're pushing too far one way, you're forgetting about the whole segment of vulnerable agents who are part. I think it's a really good point. So the agents of the sources, but also the journalists themselves. Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of things. One, future studies kind of has a way of either going to a perspective of a dystopian view or a utopian view, right? That's that same sort of thing. This is very much a dystopian view, right? That those aren't the only options. And I think as this project plays out a little bit more, I need to consider where this might fit in between those two. But I think also in these sort of solution-based elements, right? What are the critical perspectives behind that, and what damage could be done? No, I think that's really important. Yeah, thanks. Chris,
I'm just wondering, because from all the aspects of technology, I mean, yeah, it's a very American perspective.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, because I haven't kept up with this at all, but and I'm guessing you might be familiar with Joe Turow's book, The Daily You. I know he and Nick Coulter have sort of also sort of done some articles on that, but the idea of sort of, when it comes to the journalistic side of that argument, which is basically about the creation of taste communities by people who, not by advertisers, but by basically the intermediate groups that profile and sell identities of people and group them into taste communities and silos, educational silos. And he was talking in general, but he does sort of also have a sort of side note about journalism, which basically sort of is sort of dystopian future as well. Has the idea of sort of like very much sort of it being completely taken, which in American context makes sense, out of journalists' hands. So it's not the journalists saying who their audience are. Is that decision gets completely taken out of their hands as a commercial enterprise, because these intermediaries between sort of the advertisers and the newsroom, and then there's this whole intermediate thing which we don't think about, sell and package the ads that are digitally offered, which is where a lot of sort of income has to, by definition, come from. Sort of will will actually end up with sort of a digital personalization of the news that's almost, you know, slightly even automatically altering stories, which ones people see. You'll see different homepages. I haven't followed the debate, so I'm curious to what extent, when you're looking at the journalism of the future, because that's what he's predicting since 2013 or whenever that book's come out.
I think you're absolutely right. So this is about personalization, taste community. I'm just repeating it for the taste communities, and where does that sort of trail perspective kind of fit in here? No, I think very much so. I think one of the scenarios that I wouldn't have gotten to for today is this personalization and the altering of information to the degree, or the interpretation, and then the repetition of that interpretation. I think the conversation is very much so about it going in that direction. But the interesting thing is going to be how much of that, that's really interesting, how much of that conversation is going to appear in the journalistic meta-narratives that are put out there about the future from the journalists and the trade publications and the stuff that's going to make up some form of data or informed knowledge about... where do they see that? If they're talking about it. I don't think that that's being talked about as much in the communities that I'm interested in evaluating. I think it opens up too many doors of questions of a journalistic autonomy for the people that I'm interested in looking at. That makes sense? Yeah? Okay. Yeah?
You mentioned, for example, technological determinism. I was wondering what kind of take you have on that in terms of journalism.
Yeah. So I think a lot of the conversation that's how I'm reading it anyway seems to take a deterministic perspective in the sense of it be, you know, as being the sole tool and actor of civic engagement in the notions of democracy. And so my issues with the conversations as I'm reading them is not only the hyperactive role and responsibility of technology itself, but in that conversation, what do we mean by democracy? Again, this is an American perspective, which seems to also be over in a European perspective on democracy, but nobody seems to be defining what democracy is. So in that conversation of the role of technology and agency, communities, and civicness, if I'm answering your question, I'm concerned about, well, if you're saying that this is going to lead over here to a democracy, let's not even talk about the technology part yet. What do you think it's leading to? And what does that democracy look like? Because in much of the United States where I've lived, I didn't feel like I was living in a democracy. I felt like I was living, as you can probably tell, in a police state. And certainly in Northern England, you know, also a democracy feels very different than the democracy I was in someplace else. So I'm confused in that conversation about the role of technology in creating civicness towards democracy and what the end game really is that people want. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. I think I would like to add the question Scott addressed and also Chris and Esther come into like the relationship with the community and the sources and technology relate a lot to digital safety and surveillance. And you showed many of examples here. And I think we need to start taking those issues more seriously. Mm-hmm. From the perspective of the journal, we have received quite few submissions that really take digital safety, surveillance, how you handle sources. Like you're talking about Excel, I met in my own field work journalists who say, I only have my sources on a piece of paper and it never leaves the office because they don't want it to be in any digital form whatsoever. Yep. And I think we need to look into Tor networks, we need to look into cryptic forms and how you're handling those means of communication and so forth. So that's like one really interesting part of your presentation that could be upsized in future work. The other dimension, and Eddie has been working on scenarios and published on scenarios. We also have Rolf here from One IFRA, and they are also very familiar with creating scenario modeling and so forth. And your institute, of course, works with it from a sociological perspective. I think it's very important to clarify in what ways and with what ambitions you're creating scenarios.
Yeah.
Because in one way, in the industry, they can be kind of more in the rationale of trying to predict the future and working strategically.
Yeah.
But you can also create the very dystopian, utopian, to create kind of mind-blowing ideas of where are we heading and where do we want to go, and you can create scenarios more in retrospect.
Yeah.
You can think whether or not you're kind of extrapolating trends or if you're just building something wished for.
Right.
And in terms of editing, I've also received some other submissions in this vein, like Mikko Ville and other Finns had one piece in media and communication. So as we're starting to develop such type of methods and approaches in journalism studies, I think it's quite important to also try to clarify, because there are totally different rationales for working
with
scenarios.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, absolutely.
Eddie,
if I can say something about that, I think that's you're right. One thing that to me has been striking is the role of futurists in devising strategy within news organizations. So I don't know if you're familiar with AB, for instance, they have these room where they have creative technologists, which are guys that are developing the technologies that the AP is going to be using in 5 years' time. They're not actually concerned about the technologies that they currently have. the technologies that they're going to be implementing. And some of those are actually technologies of surveillance. So, you know, it's interesting, you know, people like Gerd Leonhard, who actually goes to Google, Apple, and says, well, 5 years' time, this is what's going to happen. And he forms a strategy of the companies that is happening as well with media industries. And he's been, sorry, he's big industry.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
With the comments and discussion, we're a little bit over time. We have coffee right next door, and we will be using this computer for the sessions, as we will be having somewhere around 5 to 7 minutes each to present. To create a very different atmosphere, I suggest that while we're having coffee, and I'll take a leave in the room arrangement, we group tables like this, this, and this. So the presenter is for Roboters, but we sit more like a family, and see how that goes. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Good morning again, everyone. I'm Edson. I'm from NTU in Singapore, and I'll be sharing about this recent grant that we got from the Social Science Research Council in Singapore. This is only the third year that the SSRC in Singapore is giving grants. We had in Singapore a national research foundation that has been the source of most of the grants, but 3 years ago, the government launched SSRC to specifically provide support to social science researchers, which I think is a good thing. I might not be the right person to tell about grants. This is my first major grant. I'm relatively less experienced when it comes to grant writing, but we got this. It was just announced officially early this week, so I'm very, very happy to share about what we were doing. So the grant proposal title is Defining, Determining, and Dealing with Deliberate Online Falsehoods in Singapore. So deliberate online falsehood is a term that the government actually came up with when they launched a series of public hearings to investigate the problem of fake news in Singapore. So it's a more general term to refer to different types of disinformation, fake news being one of them. But in Singapore, as in many other countries, there are different types of deliberate online falsehoods, like scams and phishing emails and whatnot. So this one I've discussed before. This presentation that I'm sharing. It's actually what I presented when we had an internal review within NTU. So I think thing that helped us is the institutional support that we got from NTU. So we get three optional rounds of review. The first two rounds, you send the actual proposal at the university level, and then they hire external people to actually look into the grant proposals, and they give us feedback. So we have an internal deadline in the school, an internal deadline in the university that occurs about 3-4 months before the actual deadline of the grant giving body. So we had our own internal levels of review. So this, the one I'm sharing, is a presentation I prepared for the third round of review, where we had the NTU assembled a panel of senior scholars from different colleges in the university, and we had to present to them, and they gave us feedback, both written and oral feedback, that then we can use to revise the grant proposal. And I think we submitted it a week after the third round of review. So I think that was helpful. Is one thing that was helpful was institutional support. So here in this grant, these are the four main questions that we wanted to ask. How do different social actors define DOS, which is more of a definitional, more exploratory question that would then lead to us asking how do they then determine, based on their definition, how do they then make sure that what they're seeing is fake or real? And then once they've determined what they're seeing is not real, how do they deal with them? And then based on the three questions that we're asking, how do we then design an intervention to address this issue? So I think one thing that I learned from working with Rich Ling, who has had a couple of lots of grants, and other people that I've worked with also had experience with grant making, is they advised me to make sure that the questions you're asking, if you break them into coherent work packages, that they inform each other. So even if you have different work packages, they still cohere into understandable whole. This proposal is actually an updated version of an earlier grant proposal I wrote that was unsuccessful. But the main change was I added the fourth work package. After the rejection, I was wondering what happened, what could I have done better. And I felt that for a problem as serious as fake news, maybe a more tangible intervention, a more tangible output, such as proposing a designing a curriculum, might be more practical for a grant-giving body. Because there will be an output. I think I was struggling with, unlike, say, funding engineering or medical-related grants, where they actually have a proposal to apply for a patent or device or technology. In social science, we rarely have, at least that was my impression, a tangible output. So I thought this is something that's close to having a tangible output. So the work package, the thing with the SSRC grant is they also want to see both practical and theoretical implications. So I also spent a lot of time thinking of building a theoretical framework using existing frameworks that we already have. So this is the framework. So this is the first work package. I divided it into several different questions. Identified the methods to address the specific research questions within the first work package. So it's more, the first one is more exploratory, building on qualitative and content analysis methods. The second work package is using experiments, then manipulating specific elements in a message queues, source queues, and then trying to predict people's response. So very briefly, the third package is, again, a series of field experiments. This is what I'm most excited about. This also then looking at the impact of corrections, and the grand idea is to build this experiment into a WhatsApp interface where we group people on WhatsApp, and that's where we send our manipulations, and that's also where we measure the response. We code how they interact. That's still very tricky because any field experiment is tricky, but that for me that's the most intellectually stimulating part of the grant. So I'm very excited to start working on this. And finally, based on all that we found, we will find in the first three work packages, I have a collaborator from the National Institute of Education and from the Ministry of Education. The goal is to then integrate all of these learnings into a curriculum that we can propose to the Ministry of Education and perhaps design something for the English language curriculum at the secondary school level. Currently, they have a cyber wellness curriculum that's on top of the normal curriculum, so we might be able to propose that on top of the cyber wellness, we could have a news media literacy curriculum. So, that's it. I'm already over time. So these are the members of the team. Making sure that I mentioned who is working on which work package and what they're bringing in. It's actually a big team. I remember when I got the second round of feedback, one person said this is too big of a team. It might be less likely to get a grant for a team this big, especially if we're aiming for the lower of the two tiers. There's a tier B, which is more than 10 million. There's a tier A, which is between 100,000 and a million. So we were aiming for only tier A for a team this big. And also one review I got, they said that the PI is very junior, because when I submitted this, I was pre-tenure. So it's a junior, so of course I'll always be junior. I think having a Rich in there, Penguin in there, all four professors in there, mixed with associates and assistant professors, I think we were able to show that this is a strong and quite diverse team. So I think that diversity also helped.
Yeah. Thank you, Edsa. Very helpful. I am, by the way, taking notes on some different sort of aspects of research design, and I'll try to make a summary later in the day in which you can then key it in. What did I miss? What other things are good? And then I'll share it with all of you. Okay, so Chris Peters.
Okay. bin anywhere.
Do you have a beaker there if you want to use?
Oh, I'm fine with that. I'm trying to throw up my gum.
Yeah, put it in here.
Okay. I'm lucky I'm going second and not last, because, of course, a lot of the things Edson says, I'm like, okay, well, good, now that's been covered, and whoever goes last is probably going to have to be, because I think we probably all say similar things about sort of our experience with grant writing. So this is the one I'm going to talk about. It's called Down the Here and Now of News. It's funded by the Independent Research Fund of Denmark with some matching funding from Roskilde University. So what is it? And I know Oscar asked about research design and all that, but it's a fairly diverse group, so I thought I actually took things a little bit more literally about like my experience with grant writing and what sort of I think about when I approach writing a grant. And I won't read the whole sort of explanation here, but basically the reason I put this up is because I think something that we often forget to do is really read closely what the actual like call is and how they specify it. Because you have this sort of short version here, right? Like this is a short version. There's two types of research projects in Denmark. This is the National Science Council, basically, of Denmark. There's a Research Project 1, which is a lesser amount. This is a Research Project 2, for those who aren't familiar with sort of Danish currency, which I imagine is everyone other than the Danes and maybe the Norwegians in the room. Basically, you're looking at this sort of amount you have plus an overhead of 44% that takes you up to about a maximum of about 900,000 euro, give or take. So ours is, it sounds wonderful when you say it, our grant is 5.4 million Danish kroner, which is about 720,000. But I think this is really important because, like, if you just look at the calls, hopefully this will open up and we'll see it, maybe not. Like, when you look at the call of these things, I mean, typically, you know, there are lots of pages, right? And I'm a little surprised sometimes when I'm asked to look over grants that it seems obvious that people haven't read it closely because they're missing things like sort of tailoring their idea to the specifics of the call itself. And even though they're often quite consistent, what you can do when you sort of read, and I always try to read the current call versus the last couple calls, is also to see how, especially for government grants, but also for private funders, like what little things have changed, even in their opening description, because that's usually a signaling point of what they're basically indicating matters to them. And so you sort of want to think a bit strategically about that, because it makes a big difference in terms of how you pitch that sort of opening thing. Because, again, for those of us who have reviewed grant applications, or just reviewed anything, the process is really similar. Think of a busy person sitting there being paid often nothing to do this job, just doing it out of their goodwill, having this stack of grants that sort of appear on their desk. And if you don't sort of grab them in the first page, you know, they tend to tune out. And sort of one of the nice pieces of advice I always got is like, basically by the end of that first page, you need to have sort of sold them that this is a good idea, it's an innovative but also a doable project. And then everything else almost becomes the tip. Okay, yeah, the work packages make sense, da-da-da-da. And to also, the other thing is to spend a good amount of time looking at work packages and methods, because what often happens is when you get a council of people assessing this is they're not, sometimes you go to external reviews in your field, sometimes you won't, but oftentimes the final decision is made by like a cross-disciplinary body. And the one thing that cross-disciplinary bodies will often focus on is method, because we won't know the specifics of the area, because if you're a historian or a philosopher or a theologian looking at my grant, you have no idea about journalism and media studies, but you'll probably know something about methods. And so that's sort of a very common area where people can feel like, I'm thinking actually, Celia, your thing yesterday, I was like, is this even doable? And then the second you're like, yeah, there's this thing called like forensic linguistics that looks at this and this, and those are the type of things that when someone's sitting on a grant review panel makes sense. So like, you know, it shows that something similar has been done before. It shows it's doable. It shows that there's some established methods. And so I think these are the sort of things I tend to think about when I'm looking at it. Another thing I'd recommend doing that I've found helpful is, like obviously, like Edson said, having like internal reviews. I've only been at Moscow now for 3 months, and I've been asked to look at 3 different grants. I think these are useful things. I think you need institutional support for that too. Also just general collegial support. Like it was, I think only the last couple of years, someone from Groningen hasn't asked me to like look something over, because that was my old university from, I left in 2015.
It's also sort of being willing to have you rely on your community. Here's who it is. We have, okay, so here are the main parts that we have. In terms of the advisory board, we actually have sort of a quite large one, and we switched ours around a bit to not only sort of make our advisory board the same as part of it, sort of not only to have academics, but also industry on our advisory board, and also specify on our advisory board that it wasn't the classic advisory board thing that happens where people show up once a year, have a nice set of chats, and I'll go home, and then you can tick the box, okay. Our advisory board has been here, but to show that they were going to be more actively involved, which then also sort of meant when asking them, sort of specifying, and Stain will attest to this for our first event, like saying, hey, we want you to be active, we want you to present things, we want you to challenge our project, we don't just want you to come in and chat. And then also to know your context, so I'm in a Danish context, so we also included sort of this three layers, a very regional layer, sort of like a Danish-only layer, to show that that was covered, then to show a Scandinavian layer, and then a broader international layer, to also be able to speak to the fact that we were plugging into these different levels. So, last little bits, I've got, what, 2 minutes left, Oscar?
Sure.
1 minute?
It's fine. Actually, we have one cancellation from Berlin, so we have a little bit more time.
Okay.
Compensate a little bit with Mariana, but yeah. Also we're a bit flexible.
Just
here.
Okay. So one thing I would say here, this is sort of a thing, preparing for it, and why I say this is because like grants are unsuccessful, more unsuccessful than successful by a lot. You often have to resubmit. Like this grant was also much like Edson's, like a second go that I had at it where I had to take in feedback. But I think from the sort of grants I've written, we always have a sort of backup plan that there's something you get out of it because the odds are you're not going to get it. Right? And you're going to spend a lot of time writing it. And the worst thing is to not get it and then just have this thing sitting there that then you're just waiting to resubmit. So also to have things like, for us, we did it as a theoretical article. So we also sort of, along with doing the grant, sort of knew we were going to develop a theoretical article and sort of a methodological framework to look at this. So even if we didn't get the grant, hey, you know, there's an output that we could use and play with. Pilot studies are sort of a, I think, even more classic way that sort of your work package one is something you don't need money to do. Because that way you can always do your work package one if you don't get it. Then you've done a pilot study, which when you go to resubmit it, you can say, hey, we did this pilot study and we found this, and with more funding we can. So there's sort of thinking about basically not just as the grant as a one thing, but as a longer 2-3 year process. So almost thinking about sort of a grant writing application, not as just the instrument, but as a longer process, I think is really useful. Because then at least you feel good, like I'm getting something out of this, I can resubmit it, I can work with it. How hilarious. 2 days in a row, you're going to see this slide, and 2 days in a row, I don't have time. If you read this, it explains this. It also explains some of the methods we're going to use. It lays things out pretty clearly. And the last thing I'd say, do something you enjoy, which should sound really bloody obvious. But I think what we get really good at in doing this profession is identifying things that aren't looked at, things that we need to look at, that should be looked at. And that's good. That's important, right? Innovation is important. The opposite is stagnation. But oftentimes we sort of get so excited about, oh, we could look at this, that I think I had this feeling when I applied for a grant in 2010, which I didn't get, of being rejected and feeling relieved. That I didn't have to spend the next 4 years doing this very clever project, if I'm being honest. I guess not quite clever enough, but a project I didn't really want to do. It was just a good project. And I think at the end of the day, it's really important to sort of sit back and actually think, why do I want to do this? Am I going to do it? It's the same thing as when you advise a PhD, right? Or a master's student doing the thesis. Like, pick something you like. Because it's such an alienating process. If you get money and you have to do something that you don't like, and you're committed to it for the next 4 years. So those would be my points. Thanks.
All right, I didn't manage to get my presentation up here, Oscar, but I might just talk.
Okay.
Yeah? Yes, so we got funding for a project that is called Far-Right Politics Online and Societal Resilience. And it's a three-year project that is funded by the Norwegian Research Council. And it was one of the thematic calls, because you have these general calls that everyone can apply for, which is very competitive, and you have the thematic calls that are narrowed down to particular kind of societal issues that are also very competitive, but gives you more of a kind of guidance in terms of what you should focus on. And as we just heard, you know, these calls are quite extensive normally, and you really need to work to find out what can be the main questions here. So it is a project collaboration between the Institute for Social Research here in Oslo, the Center for Research on Extremism from the University of Oslo, and the journalism group here at the Oslo Met. So from the Oslo Met part, it's going to be me and Tina. And I, of course, already now we've got some good advice in terms of how to kind of work to get project funding. And sometimes, you know, you do all these things and you still don't get the funding. But so I just have to second the fact that, you know, if you can work on something that you already work with or that you plan to work with, so that all the work that you put into the writing the application, that you can actually use it afterwards anyway. And some of the things that we are going to explore in this project is to assess the use of social media to strengthen the mobilizing effects of and the dissemination capacity of the far right. I'm going to be involved in the work package to assess the role of far right alternative media and the impact on the mainstream debate. So that's the kind of production side and how, you know, these kind of ideological messages can be disseminated and distributed. And then the second part of the project, which also involves kind of two work packages, look at more the impact side. So it's going to be studies on how far-right communication impact the public opinion. So that's kind of a broader survey-based study. But also to assess the specific impact on hate speech on target groups. So doing like, okay, so who's the target for these kind of messages and how do they react? How does it infect them? So when you put together this project, one important aspect is of course, okay, so you know, the kind of main idea, and then people come in with their own idea and then write maybe some work packages, but then it is really necessary to work with the whole text. And I think, you know, it's sometimes when you collaborate with people, it's easy to do, okay, everyone writes what they do that, you know, and then sometimes these applications become a little bit schizophrenic, in a sense. Because you can see there's different writing styles, it's a little bit of different entrance. So, luckily for us, we had a very experienced project leader from, from the Institute of Social Research that took this job and really went through the text many times and then sent it out to us so that we could go through it, but that it was, you know, I could see that it was kind of one voice in the research application. Another thing is, of course, to get people involved that have the right CVs and that are experts on these specific fields. And that is also takes, you know, some kind of, you need to select people and you can't involve everybody that potentially wants to be involved. So this can also be kind of a hard process, and I think for me, as a temporary staff, you know, very happy to be part of this project. That it was also the, because I've applied for a similar project like the work package here before, so it was a continuation of working something and then managed to improve it. So that's a very good thing. But as a kind of a research that also needed to get funding to be able to have a job and to learn from this experience. It's also kind of a good advice to really try to get insights from people who are experienced with doing this, and to try also to, you know, to ask them, you know, can I see, you know, what did you do and why, how did you do it? And luckily for me now, I'm also part of a project leader group here, so then I can work with an experienced project leader and get the experience to also get funding for projects in future.
the feedback that we got from the Norwegian Research Council or for this the expert group was basically that it was very kind of timely. It managed to identify very clearly some challenges that we wanted to address. All these other things as well, that it was interdisciplinary, that it used a lot of different methods, and basically that it was, you know, easy to follow between, you know, from the main aim to all the kind of research packages and then the outcome. And I think also a very good idea that we had in this project is to have a work package just like the fifth work package saying something for the theoretical ambitions. You know, not just the empirical, but then, you know, okay, so what is going to contribute with on a theoretical level, on a conceptual level? And then you can draw the insights from all these different work packages. Being in research projects from beforehand, this is also very difficult. Because, you know, in this project, you promise a lot, and then you kind of get the, you know, it takes a lot of time. So to kind of, you know, have this, to make sure that you also prioritize these kind of overall outcome from the project, I think it's very important that we also help when we try to get something next time that can show that we've actually done this. So yeah, it's a project that we're very much looking forward to do, and I think, you know, with a lot of these projects and things that we have been hearing about during this conference and workshop, you know, it seems like there's been possible to develop collaborations, which I'm very much looking forward to.
Thank you, Caroline.
That was not so. Oh. No.
Untick hide slide at the bottom.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. Introduce you to a project that I'm currently leading, which is called the Epistemologies of Digital News Production. It's a project I'm running with Professor Max Ekström at University of Gothenburg, Amanda Waldenström, which is a PhD student of his, and Seth Lewis at University of Oregon. And it's funded by the Swedish Foundation for Humanities and Social Sciences. And this is one of two main national research councils in Sweden. And we got the funding based on a 2016 application, February 2016. It was the second time we attempted, the first time we kind of went to second phase, but got rejected, with only some minor comments, because you don't get all too much feedback, actually, but at least we got some sense of this. I believe we're still encouraged to do another round, and in Sweden you can do up to 3 times on these grant applications. The success rate in general is about 5 to 7%. Once we got this, it was the only project within journalism studies, media, and communication in Sweden that year. So we felt quite lucky. It was a similar-sized project as Chris, enough to kind of buy out a few researchers on part-time for a few years and do some fieldwork, pay for some conferences and such, at least allowing us to conduct fieldwork. So we submitted it in early spring 2016, and I think one reason we got it was mere luck, because the review board made their final decisions in November, December that year, and that was right after the election in the U.S. I'm sorry to kind of point that out, but kind of fake news discussions were really on the forefront of everyone's eyes, and how can this happen? What's the role of the news media? And kind of in brief, what we tried to accomplish in this project is a very basic question. I mean, how are journalists actually producing news, and what truth claims are they taking, and how are we, what different sorts of epistemologies or different sorts of journalism may we possibly identify? And while we could debate the definition we make here of data journalism as compromising both analytics and metrics in the sort of intelligence side of the production line into how you use data and visualizations and so forth, that was one form of epistemology in digital journalism that we wanted to look into. And another form was that of participatory journalism, where we have investigated this with a special issue in media and communication, looking at participation across both proprietary and non-proprietary platforms, as we think participation occurs in so many ways if you look at how it intersects with social media, not only in your own comment fields, which many researchers have for some weird reason limited themselves to. But I think when applying in terms of advice, we got some very good ideas from Mats. I must honor his senior guidance here, because Mats is by far the professor in Sweden who has received most grant money of all scholars in journalism media and communication. And he's been on these boards previously as well. So Seth and I, as two young or fairly young scholars in our late 30s, we were very ambitious and wanted to throw in a lot. And in terms of output and impact, we were like looking at our own CVs and thinking, well, it's probably quite reasonable with a three-year project, like 15 to 20 articles and blah, blah, blah. And Mats was more like, it may well be that we produce this, but it will be too much, and we are kind of committing to too much, and it will almost kind of challenge the system that if you claim that this is possible, it's difficult. We need to keep it down, like more reasonably, like 8 to 10 or 12 or something. And I think that's an important thing, that you kind of communicate something where the reviewer committee feel that this will be pulled off successfully. They will do what they promise, rather than being too naive. We might have been too naive. And other things were to really nail down what you want to do in a very, very concrete way. And especially the first paragraph, and this feeds into what Chris Peters was talking about earlier. While you will have probably an international review board that review the grant proposal, in the end, you will have professors, in this case from social science and humanities. So it can be professors in social work or psychology, political science, so forth, who are not really experts in journalism or media, but they still need to really understand the pitch and why is this so important that we need to fund this. To really trying to think through how you communicate the importance of the project in a very layman principle. And that's really, really difficult. And possibly trying to do that in the very, very first paragraph and then kind of unpack, so that you don't wait until saying that until page 9 or 10 or whatever, it's really crystallizing at that point. It's running. We have mostly done kind of research reviews on Wikipedia entries, special issues, and so forth. We have so far hardly published at all on the data that we have collected with our different multi-method approaches, but that is something that we are currently working on. We've done field work with a commercial news publisher that works very digitally oriented, runs 28 news titles in the mid-Sweden region. They are very analytics-driven. They are commercially pressured. and quite innovative, quite fascinating place to study. So you'll hear more from us. Now let's turn to Scott.
So I did one of those things where I thought, oh, I don't need PowerPoint slides. And then Edson starts, and I'm like, I do need PowerPoint slides. So I've improved my slides. So give me just a second here. There we are. So I get to be first in the crowd of, well, that was a nice idea, but it didn't work. Discussions. So this project that I'll briefly talk about, I applied for the VIDI scheme in the Dutch Research Council. And those who, I mean, Chris is familiar, but those who aren't familiar, the Dutch have VENI, VIDI, and VICI as levels of grants that you can apply for, interpret accordingly. And VENI is for early career researchers. And I had just aged out of that based on when my PhD was awarded. So this was my first shot at the mid-career category, the VIDI category. And you get two shots for each scheme, right? So I'm not going to resubmit this in the coming year. I'm going to, you know, let it breathe and decant a bit. But I have one more shot at this. So I'll probably update and revise. Actually, based on a lot of the discussions we've had here over the past few days, you know, thinking about hyperpartisanship and alternative news. What I proposed to do in this project was look at journalistic outsiders, so digital blogs and digital actors and digital spaces and fora and things like that, which provide information which is often quickly dismissed as non-journalistic, but may have some sort of journalistic cachet, particularly with their audiences. I was encouraged by fellow digital journalism research group, Rodrigo Zenith, to call it assholes of the internet, which is a more succinct way of describing what I look at in terms of research objects. But what I really wanted to do with this study was get away from traditional media and look at other online spaces in the US, UK, and the Netherlands, which provided some understanding of news and information to publics, and really look at the way people thought about that. So it focused on the idea that news exists in a relationship between the producers of content and the receivers of content. And by looking at those sort of contexts, we could better understand what was going on. I mean, that's sort of the top line idea I wanted to look at. I particularly wanted to do this because I think certainly in the Dutch context, and you could say this in the British and the US context as well, maybe we could call that hyperpartisanship, maybe we could call it societal fragmentation or political polarization, but there are all of these dynamics that mean these places have vibrant, if not huge, but very vibrant communities of readers who read them, interact with them, and engage with them. So there was a link made to that. I was using a knowledge focus, so news as knowledge, and was going to look then at three stages. Knowledge production, news content, so the actual product, as a type of knowledge, and then how members of the public acquire knowledge from this content. So really trying to look at this in a more social, interactive way, and looking at these relationships, right, that you need to understand all three of these to really capture it. One thing about the scheme, the VIDI scheme is meant to be a scheme where you're there as the PI, and you have two, traditionally the structure is you have two PhD students under you, right? So it's basically paying for 2.7 people, two fully funded PhDs, and 7/10 of your time as a PI, because the Dutch won't ever let you fully buy out your teaching, which is fine with me. But that was sort of the idea.
And it was broken down into different packages. One was going to look at the producers of this content. One was going, or different objects. One was going to look at the producers. One was going to look at the content. One was going to look at the audience members and different studies, interactive research groups, so using tools like WhatsApp and things like that to gather audience views alongside focus groups. There was public outreach. Content had a lot of digital methodologies sort of written into how to make sense of this content. And this was going to be a mixture of situated observation and interviews to look at the people who produce these sites, so watch them do it, talk through it, but also do interviews. I had ticked all of the boxes that everyone here has said to tick, so I had an international advisory board. It had people, it had Oscar, it had people from practice, it had people in the US, it had people in the UK, it had people in the Netherlands, it had reached, you know, out in the way it was supposed to reach out. I had a connection with civic initiatives to do digital literacy education. I spoke to the Dutch Research Council's agenda items and the university's agenda items and the province's agenda items. I had done all of those things that you're told to do. Like Chris, Groningen is a department where feedback is just part of what we do. So it had been through the ringers, and everyone had given their feedback. Successful applicants in the past had given their feedback. I probably should have sent it to you, Chris, and now I will next time. But that's the culture we have, and it's a very good, productive culture. So why didn't it work out? The proposed project seems overly ambitious in terms of aims and output, which maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. You could make the case that it is, or you could make the case that I did exactly what previous successful applications had done. So I had no more publications than other successful applications had promised. I had a similar amount of packages with methods than other successful applications had done. So I think one of the lessons I took away from this process is they can't fund everyone. They have to give a reason for why they wouldn't fund you. And this is something Marcel said to me explicitly. There were more curse words when he said it to me. He also said, I bet I bleeping know who wrote that. So, you know, there is a certain amount of just taking it. Like, some of this doesn't work the way you want it to. And then this is maybe a little more something I can build on. The description how the project will create dialogue and exchanges between parties is somewhat unspecific. Fair enough, I haven't done it yet. You know, there are, like, you could sit there as the sort of angsty person and say, well, of course it's unspecific. I need to get the funding before I can pay for this event or design that thing that's going to happen in year 4 of the project. Give me a break. But at the same time, it's like, okay, next time, that won't be an issue. I will make sure that I'll tackle that. I like here, for instance, it's unspecific, although more concrete forms of engagement are described. And I think when Oscar asked me to come up with something for this, and I said, well, I've got this that didn't get funded. And I went back through it, and I thought, you know what? It's a good project. I'm still happy with it. It can be a better project and a stronger application. I can tighten some language. I can bold a few more things and make some things into bullet points and, you know, really emphasize what I want to emphasize. But I can also accept the fact that these are hyper-competitive schemes that we're all going for. So I came up with an interesting idea. I'm writing a paper using my pilot study already out of this, so next time I'll have something that will grow. One of the things our faculty advisor on grants said to me is I'm publication rich and grant poor, and I'm supervisory rich. I've supervised PhDs to successful completed PhDs, and I'm grant poor. Like, for the Dutch context, I'm a bit of a strange fish. Because most Dutch applicants, they would have no PhD supervision, but they might have been a part of a project that was funded before. And I'm the opposite. So there's a little bit of explaining myself in this that I think I'll need to do next time. So that's sort of what I did, maybe why it didn't work out. You know, it sucked when I found out. I definitely went out to the dog's bollocks with people and, you know, washed away my cares. On that day, because it, of course, came out at 5 o'clock on a Friday. But I think in the end, it's there's enough to go on, and you sort of run through the ringer, and that's the process.
Thank you, Scott.
You're very welcome.
And an extra thank also, I mean, to really go into depth about trying to understand sort of failure along the way. It's somewhat easier, perhaps, for Chris and me to say we failed first and then we succeeded, but I really appreciate that you let us learn from you while you're in the process towards
success. Well, I'm still failing.
While you're still in the process towards success. Yeah. So, Sylvia next.
Yeah.
While Sylvia next. Sure. Because
it's an interesting point that Scott is very short about institutional memory, which we don't think about, because sometimes who gives you advice on grants is interesting, because you'll have like a funding officer or maybe a research head who's like, just give it a go, you never know what happens, da da da. And I've always thought that's really bad advice, because there's an institutional memory which we don't think about, which is if you get a good review but don't get it, because not everything can be funded, like the bureaucrats who sit there and sort of decide things at the start will see that and be like, okay, it's good, so it builds. But I've often heard the sort of, well, just try, it's hyper-competitive, but like, I would never submit a bad grant because that also carries with you, even if you can only submit two times or three times, however.
Yeah.
But these little practical things, how many times you can submit, where are you in the age range?
Yeah.
I was, sorry, but Celia was going up, so that's why I was sort of...
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. Yeah. We need to...
Yeah. No,
we will definitely continue discussions over lunch and some way in the afternoon. We have Silvia, Manuel Custom, and Liliana, Andre, and Steph. Because Evelyn is not presenting anymore, it's the volunteer. Evelyn had to go. But we still have a tight schedule, so we'll keep it to
Will anyone let me know how much time?
5 to 7. Well, if you can do 5 minutes, it's good.
Yeah.
So
I'll try.
I'll let you. I'll
not like this guy.
Okay.
12.
So, I am Silvia Susanna Olvesta, and I'm a linguist. I think I am the only linguist here. I was at the University of Oslo, and I'm a postdoctoral research fellow. I have a little bit more than a year left of my postdoc, and until now, I have been doing things that not very many people are interested in. So this was my way of trying to make myself useful. Actually, and so far it's been very, very interesting, and I've really enjoyed myself here. And now the idea of interdisciplinarity really makes sense to me. And I will present the same project proposal as I presented to you yesterday. I will try not to overlap too much. And it is an interdisciplinary project, so it's 2/3 linguists and 1/3 computer scientists. And I wanted us to answer what? Well, about what? Well, like I said yesterday, we want to reveal the linguistic features of what we refer to as fake speech, the language of fake news, in three languages, Russian, English, and Norwegian. That's the linguistic part. And the computer science part is that we want to improve existing fact-checking systems by automating all and only the defining features of this fake speak. How will we go about? Well, this will, as Chris said yesterday, it will be bloody hard. This one you said? Yeah. It will be time-consuming, of course, and we will start by building corpora, and we will need several corpora. First, the Norwegian corpus we will receive from faktisk.no. Articles they have already fact-checked. So that's the Norwegian corpus. We will start with that, and if it doesn't render significant results, if it's too small, then we will find ways to extend it, for example, by using Twitter. So that's the Norwegian corpus. The English corpus will be the largest one. We will start by building corpora that already exists out there. For example, we can have articles from PolitiFact, from Snopes. etc. So some corpora are all already available. We will also, however, in order to ensure that we correct for as many biases as possible, we will also have a postdoc in linguistics who will, as part of his or her work, have the task of building this English corpus by harvesting from the internet. It will be time-consuming, but we will ask that this person has a certain competence within, for example, Python programming, etc., relevant competence. The Russian corpus, we will start with Russia Today, which was referred to yesterday, I think. Because they provide news from Russia in English, but also in Russian, which allows us to compare kind of the same articles, just in two different languages. Methods, I may be running out of time. Methods, I told you something about methods yesterday. We will use applied linguistics, including forensic linguistics, also corpus linguistics, and also rhetoric pragmatics. So rhetoric, for example, what kind of, do we find specific metaphors in this fake speak language? What kind of tropes do we find? In short, what kind of strategies are used in fake news? Now, finally, you wanted us also to say something about what we wanted to ask. And I have a couple of questions, because this application will typically, or this proposal will typically not be read by linguists. So my question for you is, what do non-linguists have to say about this project? What would be your comments? What more information would you need from me? That's one question. And second, if any of you has any idea when it comes to what the EU, ERC would be interested in such a context. Because, of course, the overall topic, fake news, is very timely and should be of interest. But what take should we have? Yeah, that's the second question. Thank you very much.
Thank you. For all of us who have ideas, for Sylvia, when was close to her at lunch, and I think many of us do. I mean, in the STEM project, Matteo and I were discussing yesterday. Matteo had ideas of mathematical modeling of how to detect between fake news and non-fake news, and the principles and linguistics certainly speak into this. So we probably all have quite a lot of ideas.
Thank you. And may I also add one thing? I would also be very interested in ways to further develop the project. So if any of you has any idea, so I would also be very open for that.
Yes. So I'm going to talk about, this is not a submitted project proposal yet, but it's a ongoing work, and it is about the automatic detection of information disorder in use by using knowledge graphs and semantic reasoning. And as you can see, I'm a computer scientist. So actually, this is a completion, maybe, or the looking at the project from the computer science perspective, where Celia was explaining a little bit earlier. So this is about the automatic detection of online disinformation. We have one of the partners as Celia, department, and she's a linguist in University of Oslo, as you know. So the idea is that how can we use the linguistic input in order to automatize the detection of online disinformation? We've been also in contact with Faktisk NO, the Norwegian fact-checking organization, and NRK. And also we've been planning to submit it to one of the polls in computer science of the Research Council of Norway, which is called ICT Plus. The call was supposed to be online or available nowadays, but it is not, so I don't know what's wrong with the Research Council. But the idea is to use semantic reasoning and knowledge graphs in order to automatize the detection process. So yesterday I showed you a little bit about knowledge graphs. It's a graphical or a graph representation of the relations between entities. This could be this can contain several steps to reach from one side to another, but it also explains the relations. For example, Bill Gates is in the board of this company and things like that. So it is possible to map the knowledge as a graph or represent the knowledge as a graph. In addition to this, in the literature, in this paper actually, it was presented a type of knowledge graph that includes some linguistic properties. Of course, the problem with this is when you add all these details about the relations between two entities, that the graph size becomes huge, and then it gets computationally so expensive to model the whole news and the relations and the claims within the news. So the aim is that we will try to find a better way to approach this and maybe incorporate some other methods, and we would like to use the insight from the linguistics. We are, of course, open to other ideas and collaborations. I think this is a truly interdisciplinary topic that we may need input from social, like all types of social sciences, probably like psychology, sociology, journalism. So we are open for collaborations, definitely. I want to just tell you about two dissemination activities that may be interest of you. One of them is a more computer science oriented. It's about news recommendation and analytics, but we are also open for like the ethics of news recommendation and the automatization of all these news-related things. The other one is in Trondheim every year in conjunction with Next Media Conference, so you are welcome to participate and send papers or just come as a listener. And
so will this year be fake news detection?
This year we will also have NOBITS. We have a theme every year, so I don't know what will be the theme this year. Growth is also involved in the process, so we can discuss it later. We also have a data set from Adresseavisen, the local newspaper in Trondheim, and it is freely accessible. Also, if you want to reach to the articles that is available for researchers, just please contact me. So these are the things that I would like to say.
Thank you. Liliana?
About one project, I'm going to mention three projects that I'm working on, which are relevant to the topics that we have been discussing over a couple of days, but I will be doing it very, very briefly. But I wanted to do that because they are at various stages of development. Some of them are in the very early stages, and it would be great to stay in touch if any of you are planning to do work or are working on any of these three topics that I'm going to discuss. The first project is the project that I am developing as part of my fellowship at the University of Oxford. It's called Science, Misinformation and the Media. This is a collaboration between the Oxford Internet Institute and the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism.
this is funded internally, so I don't think that I can give any advice that would be applicable to outside the University of Oxford. This project looks at the interplay between social media and misinformation campaigns, specifically in the context of techno-scientific issues. So moving from political misinformation to misinformation in relation to various scientific and technological issues. So for example, one of the things that we have done so far was to look at the reception of the latest climate change report released by the IPCC on YouTube and the positions that launched the report in that space. The second project that I am working on is called Beyond Verification, Authentication, Authenticity, and the Spread of Fake News. This project is hosted at Simon Fraser University in Canada, and it is a collaboration between multiple institutions. The founder here is the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council in Canada, and we are still waiting for the decision, but we think it's positive, and not just because of our project, but also I think from what I heard, the success rate for project applications to this funder in Canada is much higher than what I've heard so far from your presentations. It's going to be around 30%. So what we want to do in this project, so we want to extend the work that I presented on Monday on how platforms participate in the co-production of information disorders in general. And one way to think about what we want to do is, again, trying to move away from approaching fake news within the transmission model of communication towards a more ethnographic sensibility to the situation as an object of study. So again, this is an ethnographic concept. And really, that's around fake news. And more concretely, one of the things that we will be doing is using a method called the walkthrough method, which has been developed to study digital objects, such as mobile applications, and how they configure possibilities for legal action. And the twist is that we want to do this not just for end users and platforms, but we want to do this for the many different types of platform users, because yeah, platform users are not just the end users, say you are using Facebook via its graphical user interface, but we want to do this also for the software developers that are building applications on top of Facebook's APIs, for advertisers who are using platforms to sell their products, for political campaign managers. And all of these different users essentially access platforms through different interfaces and go through different practices and processes of configuring and participating in information disorders. And this is something that we will start doing in July at the Digital Methods Summer School. This is also an invitation for you to join us if you would like to participate in this experiment of figuring out how we can
do I have
that
information?
Very briefly,
under 1 minute.
Okay, so very briefly, the last project is one that I'm very excited about, but it's also one that is at its earliest stages and most challenging. We're still trying to figure out exactly how to frame this. This is a collaboration with sociologist Martin Morris from the University of Warwick. And basically, what we're taking as a starting point for this project are the practices of fact-checking, and particularly one aspect that fact-checkers themselves are mentioning that they are struggling with, and this is also something that was mentioned in presentations yesterday. And that's basically the fact that many public knowledge claims are not amenable to fact-checking with the methodologies that fact-checkers are currently using. Because the methodologies that they are using are more amenable for testing established facts, stabilized facts. But a lot of the claims that circulate in public discourse are more statements in the process of being formulated. They have an unstable truth value, and they may fluctuate. They change a lot over time.
So the question is, how do you deal with these statements where established fact-checking methodologies don't really work? And we have a provocative proposal for that, which is that the evaluation of these statements should remain in the public domain. It can be done by locating and evaluating what we call statement networks. So it's really a way of tracing the networks, the fluctuating networks of actors and issues assembled by the statements over time. And I can talk more about it over the next.
Thank you.
So hello everyone. By way of introducing myself, I'm not sure how many of you have heard of my name. You can just Google for a book on web content credibility, and the book should crop up. That's it. So if you want to find out more about what we have been working on as a group, that's there. The best part about it is that we started before 2016 working on this subject, before even the buzzword of fake news came up. We had a project together with EPFL Lausanne, which was called Reconcile, and that was the main basis for this book. But here, coincidentally, which is quite incredible, but fascinating, we have a very similar proposal to Silius, which is really, I think it means that there must be something in this. Consider fake news in multiple languages. We know that the banking systems exist in English, classifiers are being built in English, the same happens probably in Norwegian, there is a debunking system there. On the other hand, in Polish, there is no debunking system. I should put a red cross on that. But perhaps there are people working on constructing one. So what can we do about this? Well, one idea is this. Let's translate everything into English. I mean, why not? We have Google Translate. Let's do that. And let's just leave all the verification part in English, where most of the debunking things work anyway, right? Now, of course, there are drawbacks to this idea, and there are some on the list here, right? Obviously, you cannot do everything that way. Some, perhaps very important, fake news actually only have a significance in the local language. They may have a lot of importance for local politics, for example, right? On the other hand, we will lose some people, right? We are not talking just about the totally literate computer scientists and linguists and digital journalists who speak multiple languages. We are talking about the public, who may not speak other languages or English, especially in Poland. So, what about the different idea? Let's keep these debunking systems working independently, but translate their output. Again, there are just websites, we have Google Translate, why not just do that, right? And that's certainly an alternative, but this may work, maybe even work for humans who are good at also understanding the errors of machine translation, looking through the errors of that, right? But it will definitely not work well for machines. I mean, this kind of an approach, whenever you want to actually do something automatically, the machine translation may confuse that as an input, right? So it will be actually very hard, and it will not resolve any interoperability problems, because we will have different websites with totally different, maybe actually the most interesting part about that, there may be totally different procedures involved in the verification process. This might not be the same in all of these debunking sites, right? Maybe not even the same in one language, right? These procedures might be different. So what we are proposing is to have a higher level of integration, right? And similarly to many ideas that Celia talked about, this is all about actually a representation of of this into one cross-lingual representation of fake news, right? That's the most important part. What's the goal of that? Actually, we'll come back to this in a moment, but let's first focus on what you can do with this, right? First of all, if you just look at the fake news from the point of view of fact statements, some kind of statement of fact, right? You can probably use many different ways, like the graph ways that have already have been mentioned. Another candidate would be to use vector representations, where the embeddings, for example, can be mapped into categories, into topical categories, and that might be disenriched. The representation might be actually a candidate for this cross-lingual representation of fake news. That would be the main goal, actually, of this project, to work on that, right? The stylometric features, which Celia has mostly focused on, are of course also an interesting candidate of doing that. For example, sentiment. We have lexicons of sentiment, which are already through the Clarin project, which I'm also representing a little bit here, the Polish part of the Clarin project, represented in multiple languages. All right, why would this platform be better? Well, first of all, one of these things is the speed of debunking. You can imagine very easily that it fake news will be available, for example, first in English and then translated into many, many, many other languages. And that's the point where we can actually step in, because in English they will be old news. In the new language, it will be new news. Why debunk it from the... Why try to verify this from the start, right? When we can actually do it differently. And the other thing is to actually extend the community, right? And that would be something that is really worthwhile, because you can get more eyeballs, that's first of all, but you can also tackle fake news, which would be also very interesting for the kind of project, which has significance in multiple languages, and it's important to actually bring in people from two different communities to verify. What are the challenges? Well, first of all, representing, as I said, the cross-language representation of this is the main challenge of the project, I would say, from the point of view of linguistic and computational linguistics and computer science, also in a way, and then use that to develop tools for earlier fake news detection, for comparing similar fake news across languages, or maybe even in the same language. The same cross-lingual representation can be used to compare similar used in the same language. Okay, since I'm running out of time a little bit, let me give you a last slide of the presentation, which is about a grant opportunity. We have been talking a lot on how to write a good grant, but here is actually an upcoming call, which is focused on a Polish-Norwegian collaboration. There will be only a single call in mid-June of 2019, and it's a medium project size. It's open for all science, with an actual focus on social science. I'm telling you things which I have learned from the Polish National Science Center before a call is published. So, treat this as fake news. or at least something which needs to be verified. The call will be published mid-June, right? So, the good things about it, there are several good things about it, in my opinion, is that the international experts actually reviewing this, and this is actually being like similar to Horizon 2020. At least that's what they declared that they want to do, right? This is actually, I think, a good thing, right? So here's an opportunity, and maybe let's use the accumulated experience from all of these things that we've been talking about to actually write good proposals for this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome Stan to the stage as the final presenter in the round.
The link has pulled.
Luckily, not the whole of you. While you saw, we are going to try to find the time for meeting with Adam, after the scheduled session today or tomorrow. Adam is reaching out to us here to establish opportunity to develop such a research grant proposal. Thankfully, he has already developed parts of it, and I have talked to some of you that he will be coming in and there's this opportunity. And obviously, Celia should be taking part in those discussions. We'll try to coordinate this. So, Stan.
Yeah, thanks, Oscar. It's always nice to be the one person standing between a lunch and an audience, so I'll be as brief as I possibly can, and those of you who were present yesterday learned a bit about this project already, which is called Source Criticism and Mediated Disinformation Scan, which I think should be funded solely because of having a great obligation. We submitted it this last year to the Norwegian Research Council. We got good reviews, didn't get funded. We have revised it, resubmitted it now. Briefly, this is a problem we're identifying with the future of disinformation due to new technologies, platforms, and actors. The solution we're proposing, digital source criticism. The objective, to develop principles for and practices of digital source criticism and media and information literacy in relation to emerging technologies with special emphasis on detection and countering of disinformation. This is the beautiful team, apart from the guy in the middle. Sten, myself, Bente, Karsnes, Oscar, Valerie Breer, Vignon, Lucas Graves, and one postdoc. This is the advisory board, classical advisory board setup with some Norwegian, Canadians, and some international scholars. We have three work packages, two quite large ones, two large empirical ones. This is the first one, which Oscar will lead, to look into what are the key technological developments influencing digital source criticism practices, where we will do both interviews with various tech and platform companies and fact-checking organizations, and I will briefly mention in relation to this that we will host the 2020 Global Fact-Checking Conference here at Oslo Met, which will give us a nice opportunity to sort of have all the fact-checking organizations in the world, basically, we can include in this project. And we'll also look at specific technologies to so-called technography of them, so figuring out how they function, how they work, and stuff like that. So that's the sort of the technology work package. The practice work package will look at how both journalistic institutions and fact-checking organizations, how they deal with new technologies, basically. We've spent the Karlsnes to lead this work package. And this will be in relation to, we will do this both in Norway, the UK, and the US, related to elections, the presidential elections in the US 2020, and the Norwegian parliamentary elections in Norway in 2021. The third work package, and this we've learned from Kalduna and Tina, to have a theoretical work package, so developing the conceptual theoretical framework of digital source criticism and the broader implications for media and information literacy. And then we also have a fourth work package, which I learned from a previous project that we got funded here, which ended in 2017, where we had a work package sort of just to bring together all dissemination, engagement, and impact activities, which was quite successful in that previous project. So here you can see all the different tasks of the way to that. That's it. I'll say no more. Let's have lunch. Thanks.